So okay, as Pedro said, this colloquium is basically a part of this conference that we've been having here this week. And it's a conference about conformal field theory. So my goal will be to explain why we are interested in conformal field theories and then give like a brief summary of the main ideas that we've been discussing here, okay? So there's three main parts. First one is really motivation, and as the title indicated, I'll pay special attention to this quantum gravity motivation to study conformal field theory. And then in the second part, I'll try to give some brief overview of the several approaches to conformal field theory that we discussed here during the conference. And then I'll finish with some comments on open problems. Okay, so why study conformal field theory? So the first obvious answer comes from the theory of continuous phase transitions, okay? So even in water, in our very own favorite liquid, after wine, of course, there is this very nice phase diagram. So we all know that as you increase the temperature at fixed pressure, water boils and turns into vapor. Usually that at atmospheric pressure, that's a first order phase transition, there's some latent heat. But if you increase the pressure enough, at some point this first order phase transition ends in a critical point. And at this critical point, the system is scale invariant. So it has fluctuations, like for example in the density, in all length scales, okay? The correlation length diverges as you approach this critical point. And in fact, you can measure critical exponents associated to this critical point. So here, it's a plot. It's actually an experimental plot, so I couldn't resist. It's very rare for a string theorist like me to show you an experimental plot in a talk, so here you are. So this experimental plot is of the correlation length with respect to the distance from the critical temperature at this critical point. And you, in this log-log plot, you clearly see this linear behavior, and you can measure this critical exponent. And actually, you realize that this critical exponent is exactly the same that controls the critical point in the 3D Ising model, okay? So this is this notion in statistical mechanics that you have this universality. So several systems at criticality are described by the same critical exponents. And essentially, the modern understanding of this is that each universality class corresponds to a conformal field theory. So at the critical point, you have this scale invariant system that is described by a conformal field theory. So actually, conformal symmetry is bigger than scale invariance. So you would just expect scale invariance, but actually, this is an important discussion that we had a bit yesterday. For example, Marcos Lutti gave a nice talk about this idea. But in general, under very reasonable assumptions, actually, if you have scale invariance, you also get conformal invariance for free. So this will be our main assumption. Okay, so there you are. One important motivation: study critical exponents of continuous phase transitions. There's another very interesting motivation to study conformal field theories that comes from particle physics, but essentially I will not discuss anything about this because in last year's Back to the Bootstrap 1, Slava gave an excellent colloquium about his work on this topic. So I strongly recommend that you watch his colloquium. Let me just say that it's actually a bit surprising for me that in particle physics, we never found a non-trivial conformal field theory. I mean, as you go up and up and up in energy, at some point, it should be natural that we can find some non-trivial, strongly coupled conformal field theory. So far, as we go up, we just see like free theories or you can see a theory that confines, but you never see a non-trivial conformal field theory. But I mean, I think this is just, I don't see any obvious explanation why it can happen, cannot happen in the next energy scale. Okay, so this is two motivations. So let me now give you the third motivation, which is actually the one that I'm, that motivates me more personally. And so this idea that this application to quantum gravity. So, okay. So here I want to discuss this in a bit more detail, and to immediately clarify this discussion, I need to tell you what do I mean by quantum gravity, okay? So quantum gravity, I just mean really a normal quantum theory with all the axioms of quantum mechanics, but that at low energies, it reduces to the dynamics of general relativity, okay? It's what we call a UV completion of general relativity, okay? So the idea is that you should view general relativity as an effective field theory that works at low energies, but it's not a complete theory. It should be completed by something else, and then you will have quantum mechanics, normal rules of quantum mechanics all over, okay? And, I mean, the basic signal that it's an effective field theory is that the coupling constant is dimension full, so you have this Planck mass that tells you that at some high energy scale, the theory will break down, and you'll need the new states in the theory, okay? So this is the, I mean, this is the standard definition of quantum gravity, the most conservative one. So in particular, if we want to study quantum gravity, if we want to find the UV completion of quantum gravity, it must have the same low-lying energy spectrum as general relativity, okay? So this is the first basic idea. But what is the spectrum of quantum gravity, okay? If you do in flat space, I mean, gravitons can have arbitrarily low momenta, and so the spectrum is continuous. It's a very complicated problem. You have lots of infrared divergences. So the first thing you should do to tackle this problem is to put the theory in a box so that you get rid of the infrared divergence, okay? So that's what we're going to do. We need to put gravity in a box. So this is very hard, right? It's not like we put a mirror and the electromagnetic waves just reflect. Eh? Gravitational waves just go through anything, okay? So it's hard to make a box, but we know how to make a box, at least theoretically, okay? So until the Sitter space is just a box for gravity. It's actually a box for everything, also for electromagnetic waves. And okay, I wrote the metric up there, but essentially you just need to understand this picture, okay? So I want to think it's a four-dimensional space-time, okay? So time is, t is just your time, and r is a radial coordinate, okay? It's the distance away from you. You are like at the center of the universe. But as r goes to infinity, you have like two spheres around you, and their radius, instead of increasing just with r squared, it increases exponentially with r, okay? It's some hyperbolic geometry, if you want. And the main point about this is that I want to take this r, this capital R, this parameter here, which essentially will be the size of the box, very, very large, okay? This is just a regulator. I want to be able to put galaxies inside this box, okay? So that we can study all the physics, all the astrophysics, interesting stuff inside the box. It's just a regulator, okay? And so when we are here, close to the center, much smaller than the size of the box, everything is gonna be like in flat space, okay? We're not gonna change the physics. It's just really a regulator, an infrared regulator. Okay, this is one point that I want to emphasize. The other point is that this is a box in the sense that if you send light or gravitational waves, they will reach the boundary, bounce, and hit you back in finite time, okay? So it's really a box in that sense. And in particular, the immediate effect of that is that gravitational waves will have a discrete spectrum, okay? So in this box, the spectrum will be quantized in units of this 1 over r, which is the size of the box, and it will be some discrete spectrum. It's actually very simple, some integers start 3, 4, 5, all the way up to infinity, okay? Very simple spectrum.
Is the put in the box like a cubic box, just a periodic boundary condition. Why that's not a cubic box?
Because it will be useful to have a boundary so that we can probe the system. You see, we want to be able to probe the system from infinity, because these are the good observables in quantum gravity.
Okay, but boundary may be causing some problem, because the boundary can be sharp. Again, there's a
No, no, but okay,
now,
here.
The boundary condition, you know, there's a no sharp edge, no sharp boundary. So it's everywhere.
So this is, I mean, this boundary is not really sharp. This is like the conformal boundary. As you go to infinity, you rescale the metric. But, I mean, for the practical purposes of the physics, it's like being sharp, really things reflect. But it's like, for example, one thing is that this box doesn't have a center. It's completely symmetric. All points are the same. So it's not like one point is closer to the boundary. It's a bit more elegant than that. Yeah, it's a box with walls, with boundaries, but no center. All points are the same. Okay. Okay.
But when you describe the mode, do you need to describe a boundary condition?
Yes, you need.
So that's a sort of kind of boundary. What does that say? If you have a periodic box, you don't need to describe a boundary condition. It's a continuous.
True. No, that you could try to do that, but I think you would have the problem that then you wouldn't have natural probes to test the system. You see, because you cannot just like put a local source in the manifold in quantum gravity in space-time. There's no notion of a local measuring device, you see? So here it's important to have this boundary so that you can do like scattering experiments sending in sources from infinity, because you're allowed to fix the boundary at infinity. Okay? You should think of quantum gravity as like giving you a partition function as a function of the boundary metric, of the boundary geometry. Okay, so that's your definition. So you need to have some sources that you can turn on to probe the system. Okay, so but this is just like the one particle spectrum, but now you can put several particles. But what you know is that at low energies, essentially this say two gravitons will interact very weakly, and it's actually. You can even use like a Newtonian-like formula for the interaction energy between these two gravitons. And essentially, since the energy is of order of 1 over the radius of the box, you see that the interaction energy in units of the size of the box is suppressed by this very small parameter, okay? This ratio of the Planck length to the size of the box, that is bigger than the galaxy, okay? This small parameter will be all over the following slide, so you should think about it. So this is the other property of the low-lying spectrum. And still another obvious property is that if you just want to put gravity here and no other matter, then you don't have any other states besides these gravitons. Okay? This is my choice. If I want just to find a UV completion of pure gravity, then I will only have these states. There's no other low-energy states besides gravitons. Okay, so then, there you are. Do we know any good quantum system that has this low energy spectrum? And there's one very natural answer, which is, as you should expect, conformal field theory. So to explain that, let me just explain this picture here. First of all, I didn't emphasize this idea properly, but conformal field theory living in one lower dimension, okay? So in three dimensions. We were doing physics in four space-time dimensions. Now the conformal field theory will live in three dimensions. So you should think of the conformal field theory as living on this boundary of the cylinder that I showed before. So essentially it will have time, and then it will live on this two-sphere that appears at infinity, okay? But the idea is that in conformal field theory, there's a very simple map from Euclidean space, three-dimensional Euclidean space, to this cylinder. Okay, you just take this Euclidean space in radial, in spherical coordinates, and you map your radial coordinate like exponential of some time t, and that will give you this metric the two sphere times time, okay? But then you see immediately something is that dilatations here in R3, okay, making the circles bigger, just corresponds to time translation here, okay? So this is one very important idea in conformal field theory, is that the spectrum of this dilatation operator on Euclidean space is exactly the same as the spectrum of the Hamiltonian in this S2 picture, okay? So if we want to understand the spectrum of conformal field theory in this cylinder, this is exactly equivalent to understanding the spectrum of the dilatation operator in this picture, okay? And moreover, you can be more precise about this, this correspondence, because here, the natural objects that have a non-trivial eigenvalue of the dilatation operator are local operators that you can insert, say, at the origin. Okay, then you rescale them and you just measure the dimension of this operator. So essentially, dimensions of local operators map into energy of states in this two sphere. Okay, so this slide is just to tell you that I was explained to you what was the basic properties of the spectrum of quantum gravity in this cylinder, and now I'll try to reproduce that as a spectrum of the dilatation operator of a conformal field theory. Okay, but this is exactly equivalent to saying it's the same spectrum of the conformal field theory on this cylinder. Okay.
You talk about the spectrum of quantum gravity, and supposing this specific space, there's a one quantum state, I assume. Then how many first excited are there?
Sorry, I didn't understand. In anti-de-Sitter
state? I suppose you have one ground state.
One?
Ground state.
No state.
Ground
state. Sorry, ground state. I'm sorry. Yes.
And then the question is, since I try to understand the state, what do you mean by spectrum? So I try to say how many...
The ground state...
excited states.
Yeah, I'm
so
talking about the...
But how many of them? And what are they?
So you should be... you should demand that you have the same spectrum up to a UV cutoff, which is, I mean, at the same order of the Planck mass, or at least parametrically larger than the size of the box, right? Quantum gravity, general relativity is good up to some high energy.
But I mean low energy spectrum, I say.
Yeah.
So the ground state, so energy zero.
Yeah, it's gap.
The excited state is the one over R.
Yes.
So what is the degeneracy of the first excited state?
The degeneracy?
Not degenerate.
It's non-degenerate.
Because gravity have this elasticity, you know, plus 2 minus 2. Now at least for the torus geometry, you're degenerate. You know, elasticity.
No, here the first excited the first excited state. Is unique. Yeah. I guess it's a spin. It's a spin two state. You'll see. It's a state created by the energy momentum tensor. So okay, there's some spin degeneracy, but it's a single representation. Yeah.
It's a single representation, but okay. So basically, that's what we're trying to match. So whether every conformal field theory operator would correspond to a single excited state in the gravity or correspond to the single representation in the gravity, you know, there's some...
Single state. Because Tim, you can also choose different polarizations, and that corresponds to a single state. It's exactly the same.
In particle physics, we don't usually distinguish different spin states of the same particle. We count them as one particle.
But here the question is, so we have a Hamiltonian evolution. You know, when I have Hamiltonian will have spectrum. I'm asking about this spectrum, this Hamiltonian.
Yeah, so this spin, so the rotation of these two sphere commutes with the Hamiltonian. So the spectrum will be organized in this SO3 representations, and there will be a spin 2 representation of the first excited level.
So there's 5 for degeneracy?
Yes.
Or 2 for degeneracy? Because elasticity only plus 1, 2, if a massive particle will be 5 for degeneracy.
Ah, sorry, yes, because there's conservation, so you kill some of the states, yeah. Yeah, there should be only 2 states, yeah. Okay, that might become clear in this picture. So what we're saying is, so then let's analyze the CFT spectrum of the dilatation operator. Okay, so So one obvious thing, you always have this stress tensor operator in a conformal field theory. Okay? So you can measure the dimension of the stress tensor operator, and in three dimensions, it's just three. And now you can also take derivatives of this stress tensor operator, and that just increases the dimensions by 3 plus integers. So this is exactly the same spectrum of gravitons, of one graviton in an entity sitter. But now you can you should also be able to reproduce many gravitons in an entity sitter. So for example, if you put two insertions inside this circle and you try to measure the dimension of this operator, of the state created by these two operators. So let's take this example where you take the limit where they go to the same point. Essentially, you have the sum of dimensions, and then you have some anomalous dimension, if you want, some interaction dimension. And now here, in a generic conformal field theory, this can be anything, okay? So here you have the first constraint. If you want this to be quantum gravity, then this interaction dimension has to be very small in this parameter. This was a very, very small parameter. Okay? This is your first constraint that comes. You have to have a CFT such that when you take multiple insertions of T mu nu, the dimension is essentially the sum of each single T mu nu and plus a very small, small correction. And the other property that was completely trivial in ADS, just requiring that there's only gravitons, here turns into an even more non-trivial statement about the conformal field theory. So you should not be able to find in your conformal field theory any other operator with a dimension lower than your cutoff in units of the size of the box. Okay.
What does that circle represent?
This circle represents, if you go back to this picture, if you this circle here maps to like a constant time surface on the cylinder, so it represents where you read off the state. Okay.
So if the both inside the circle is before a certain time.
Yes. Okay. So you should have complained already because I'm just talking about the spectrum. To match the spectrum of you can just write an Hamiltonian with whatever spectrum you want, right? So this is very easy to UV complete. So you need to demand more than just reproducing the same spectrum. You need to demand that all observables that you can compute in quantum gravity, you can also compute in this conformal field theory, okay? So, but this is actually true. So essentially, from the conformal field theory point of view, there's very natural observables, which is just to take correlation functions of many insertions of the stress energy tensor, okay? Endpoint functions of the stress energy tensor. But in fact, this is precisely the only observable that you can compute in quantum gravity. So as I already pointed out, essentially, if you're really doing quantum gravity, what the only thing you can do is say compute the free energy of the system with as a function of the boundary metric. And that will just be like the generating functional for these correlators of T mu nu, right? You can take functional derivative with respect to the boundary metric, and that defines you this T mu nu insertion. Okay. So well there's this statement that there's no local observables in quantum gravity. Well, Niemann in his colloquium explained this very physically. Essentially, it's the problem that if you want to measure something locally with arbitrary precision, you need an apparatus with infinite mass. And in gravity, infinite mass inside some region just forms a black hole. So there's an intrinsic limitation to measure an observable to arbitrary precision. So the only observables that are really well defined are observables from infinity. Okay.
Sorry, last question. Is this an energy for graviton observable or not?
It is observable because it will appear.
So it's not.
No, it will appear like if you look at the two-point function, it will appear like
that
some.
That is physical.
If you take Fourier transform with respect to time, you will see poles at the spectrum. Good, but this picture then of the observables translates into another condition. is that again, so if you think about the calculation of this correlation function in terms of a gravity process, essentially inserting this energy momentum tensor operators at the boundary, what it's doing is to create like a graviton that then goes inside this box and scatters. Okay, so if you have some endpoint function and you have to send many gravitons inside and connect them so that you have the connected correlator, so whenever you have that, you need to use interaction vertices. And these interactions are very weak because the effective interaction coupling is always this ratio of L Planck over the radius of your entity sitter space. Okay, so this Planck length over the size of the box. So this is the other basic property that you need to impose if you want to be able to describe quantum gravity. Okay.
So this correspondence is true at all group levels or just
two levels? So this argument here is perturbative, right? I'm drawing here some diagram. But the point is that if the size of the box is much bigger than the Planck length, like we want it to be, then, and if these points are just some random points not particularly aligned, then this correlator will be very well approximated by a perturbative calculation. Okay, so you know, I mean, this is a non-perturbative definition, this correlator of stress tensors in the conformal field theory. But it has to be, but the connected part has to be suppressed by this parameter. Okay, so we get to the main point that I wanted to explain, is that you should really define quantum gravity as a conformal field theory. It's a very special conformal field theory, not any conformal field theory. It has to be a conformal field theory that matches these expectations that we need at low energy to reduce to general relativity, okay? But, So the basic properties I already told you. So you need to impose this large gap that there's no other operators that create states that are not gravitons. And you have to impose this factorization that essentially the interaction is very weak when you is suppressed by this Planck mass in units of the size of the box, okay? So let me really emphasize that we're not losing anything when we do this construction, okay? If by any other means someone can UV complete quantum gravity, okay, some other way of defining quantum gravity, he puts it in ADS, computes correlators, or if you want, computes the partition function as a function of the boundary metric, and that defines all these correlations of team nu, and that will, by construction, be a conformal field theory, okay? So if you look in the space of conformal field theories, all possible UV completions of quantum gravity will be there. It's not that we are restricting our analysis. Okay? I think that's why this can be viewed as a definition. You're not losing any information when you do that. Okay, and you already saw the picture. It really looks like that, right? This is our CFT lives on the surface of this ball. Okay? And we can measure, we can put gravitons going inside, make black holes inside, but here we are safe. Time is universal for us, we can do everything safe. It's just, we're just probing quantum gravity from the outside, okay? So this is how you should think of AVS CFT. Good, so now comes the, yes.
Can you describe the previous condition using the dimension, the scaling dimension, and try to translate?
Yes, the scaling. I use the scaling dimension.
So the first one, that means a scaling dimension for other operators be much bigger than one.
Parametrically bigger.
Is a 100 will be bigger enough?
No.
So large in issue.
It depends. If you
Planck length and the size of the universe, you need that kind of scale.
Okay. If you want to be if it's 100 or 1,000, it would already look like quantum gravity inside the box. But if you want to be able to take the limit where it looks like quantum gravity in flat space,
yeah,
it really has to be parametrically larger. Because in flat space, you want to have some fixed UV cutoff that is fixed when you send the size of the box to infinity. So So if this UV cutoff is fixed when r goes to infinity, this really has to be parametrically large. So you really need a family of CFTs that has increasingly larger gap, arbitrarily large gap.
So this parameter large means if you measure the size of the box in Planck scale, then this delta should be as large as that.
Yes.
Okay. And so then the other, so that's only condition, and the rest of the operator just have dimension order one. If T all have dimension order one.
So, yeah, only operators made from T, yeah.
And they all have dimension order one.
Yeah, those will have this dimension 3, 4, 5.
Anomalous dimension also order 1. Don't have to be very small.
Well, T cannot get anomalous dimension. But okay. Then the anomalous dimensions of 2Ts. Okay. So in the OPE of 2Ts, you will have something like integers plus a very small number. Also parametrically smaller, right?
So again,
but that follows from this condition. That's why I didn't write it again. Because of this factorization already implies that.
So again, it depends on the size of the box.
Depends on the size of the box.
What is the distinction you're making between lambda UV and lambda?
It's not that. So in string theory, lambda UV is the string length, right? So it's not necessarily the same as the Planck length. But at the level of this discussion, probably it would be easier to put both equal. Yeah. So.
Well, in theory, they're the same, right?
Yes. So I'm just saying that it allows you some more freedom, but right, you really don't need general relativity to be good until the Planck scale. It could be until square root of the Planck scale. I don't know, go scale some crazy way. So okay, but now comes the really important question: can we find these CFTs? Right? Well, you should guess from the title, right? We're still looking for. So. So what do we need? We need a conformal field theory in three dimensions. That's not hard. There's many. You can, with Chern-Simons, gauge theories coupled to some matter fields, either scalars or fermions, you can engineer many conformal field theories. So that's okay. Factorization is also easy. So this comes for free if you take a large n gauge theory. Okay. You take your fields to be n by n matrices, so then your stress energy tensor will be some trace of products of fields. And essentially, just the large n expansion gives you for free this factorization. And essentially, this n is identified with this large parameter, the size of the box in Planck units. So the problem comes in the gap, right? Because if you just follow this, try to make some gauge theory, some large n gauge theory, there will be lots of operators that, at least in the free theory, have small dimension, of order one dimension. So what you really need, and this is essential, there's no way out, you need to go to strong coupling such that the anomalous dimensions of all the other operators except Tmu become parametrically large. Okay? So this is something very hard to get in a conformal field theory.
So you really want the field theory construction of the CFT? Because in some sense, I could just define the CFT to a dictionary.
No, but that is, you just define some correlate. You don't define a UV complete theory, right? UV complete. Gravity, yeah. So, okay, if this line was not here, this would be basically crazy. I think nobody would, how can you expect that all operators get parametrically large? It's really hard that this happens. But in explicit examples in ADS CFT, we see that this happens. So, I'm talking about three dimensions. This happens in n equals 4 supering mills in four dimensions. But since I'm talking three dimensions, so there's this theory, ABJM theory, which is precisely one of these Chern-Simons gauge theories, supersymmetric theory, that does this. The only states that stay are the states that correspond to the, if you want, to supergravity states. Yes. So the only examples we know give you supergravity in 10 dimensions. They never give you supergravity, gravity in 4 or even supergravity in 4. They always give you higher dimensional version of supergravity. So, but okay, still that is highly non-trivial. There's an infinite set of operators that get parametrically large dimensions. So the question is, can we find it or not?
But supergravity would contain extra operators in addition to N-numerical tensor, which also have a small dimension.
Yes, so those stay with a finite dimension. They're actually protected because their dimension cannot
increase. That's a bad feature. From your definition, you only
So what I'm saying is that if my title was looking for quantum supergravity, then it could be done, okay? So that's why it's hard. We still haven't done it. Okay, so just some comments. I basically already explained this, but so the idea is that I want to be able, this R, I really, it's just a regulator. So I want to be able to take R to infinity and recover flat space physics. So that can be done. It's a bit technical because you want to reproduce local physics using probes that you send in from the boundary. So you have to like focus some wave packets, but it can be done. And this works. And actually, led to further interest in this Malling representation of conformal correlation functions that we'll have a nice discussion tomorrow afternoon. So if you want to know how to go from antithesis theater to flat space, you should come to the talk tomorrow afternoon. Okay, so this basically finishes my presentation, my motivation. So I wanted to think of the space of conformal field theories as this huge landscape full of treasures, okay? And we are hunting. That's the idea. Okay, so let's move on to the second part where I actually tell you what we can do and what we've been trying to do during this workshop. Okay, so the main problem is that this space of conformal field theories is very, very large. So can we organize it in some way? Is there any way of organizing this conformal field theories? So one basic idea comes from the idea of renormalization group flows. Okay, so you can start from some conformal field theory. That's your definition of the theory in the ultraviolet, and then you can introduce some relevant deformation such that that generates a flow as you look to the theory at larger and larger scales. Okay, so if you do that, either you end up in some trivial theory where all states become gapped, or you end up in another conformal field theory. So there's this idea that conformal field theories can be connected by an RG flow, okay? But which ones? Can we connect all conformal field theories or only some of them? So only some of them. And in T equals 2, there's a old theorem by Zamolodchikov that explains exactly how why you cannot connect all CFTs by RG flows. So the idea is that Zamolodchikov proves that there is a function, let's call it C, that always decreases under the RG flow, okay? So this function always decreases, and it's stationary both in when you are at the fixed point at the RG flow, both at the UV fixed point and the infrared fixed point. So therefore, it's obvious that if you evaluate this function here, it will be bigger than in the infrared, okay? So you have this inequality. And therefore, you can only go down. There's no flow that connects this, that flows from this CFT to that CFT. So it's like a height function in the space of conformal field theories. So, good. So the other property I want to say, why is this natural? Well, there's a natural intuition for this, right? Because when you are flowing to the infrared, you are integrating out the high energy degrees of freedom, right? So you expect that the number of degrees of freedom should decrease. So So it's an irreversible process. You're losing information as if. So okay, this is your function that decreases, so it keeps the information that the flow is irreversible. So when I said here that this function at the fixed point is equal to the central charge. So what is the central charge of the CFT? Okay, this is an interesting question. So I wrote here four definitions for 2D CFTs. So my favorite is the first one. I think it's the more physical one. So this is the entropy density of the system at finite temperature. Okay? You have your 1 plus 1 conformal field theory. You put the system at finite temperature. There's no scale, so the entropy density has to be proportional to the temperature. The constant defines the central charge. So looks like a good measure of the number of degrees of freedom. Okay, and you can also, the same constant appears in the two-point function of stress tensor. And it also appears when you put the theory in a curved background. Okay, so if it's a conformal field theory, we're used to think that the trace of the energy momentum tensor has to vanish. But this is only true in flat space. If the theory is in a curved background, in a curved geometry, then there's a conformal anomaly, and the trace is actually proportional to the Ricci scalar, so the curvature of your background manifold, and the constant of proportionality is, again, this central charge. And okay, this is another definition that follows immediately from this. If you put it on a sphere, then this trace will be a constant, and if you integrate on the sphere, you get, again, see. Okay, so this is very nice, this idea in two dimensions. What about in four dimensions? Can we also prove a C theorem, define some kind of C function in four dimensions? Well, you immediately encounter a problem, because if you look at the same four definitions, instead of having one constant, now we have three constants. Okay? So there's some constant that controls the entropy density. There's some other constant that controls the two-point function of the stress tensor. And if you put the theory in a curved manifold, there's two constants that appear, because here you can have more curvature invariants that depend on the geometry where you put your conformal field theory. So, okay, this is just the square of the Weyl tensor, and this is the Euler density, is just some particular combination of the curvature squares of the curvature. And so you have these three parameters, C tilde, A, and C. So which one should it be? So actually, Cardi in 88 conjectured that it should be this A, contrary to my physical intuition that this C tilde should be the real measure of degrees of freedom. But that's just wrong. You really need to rethink your intuition. But it's true. That one does not show an irreversible flow under RG flow. It's this parameter A that you can also define by this integral on the S4. And this is very nice, because actually this was proven just last year after back to the bootstrap one. So like between the two conferences, we had one of these major developments that now we have a theorem that tells us that in 4D, we also have a C function that unfortunately became an A by bad naming of these anomalies historically. Okay, and we can keep going. So what about 3D? 3D, it's a mystery immediately, because there's no anomaly. You put in a curved manifold, and it's zero. It's not sensitive to the curvature. So what we did in 2D and in 4D, there's no inspiration for doing in 3D. But actually, there's other ways of doing it. And it's still, so the basic idea is still related to putting the theory in a sphere. So if you put the theory in a sphere, but now instead of integrating the trace of the stress tensor, you just compute the free energy, okay? The log of the partition function. That's an F. So now you have an F theorem. It's a bit unfortunate, but it's good to learn the alphabet. So, but actually, the first time that this was proposed was by our very own Rob Myers and Aninda Sinha, and it was in a different definition. So you can actually show that this partition function, this free energy on S3, is exactly equivalent to the entanglement entropy of the region inside a circle and the rest of the space when the theory is in the ground state, when your conformal field theory is in the ground state. So this F can be defined both as this entanglement entropy of the circle or as the free energy on the Euclidean tree sphere, okay? And again, even this year, again, between bootstrap 1 and bootstrap 2, we essentially have a proof of this theorem based on properties of entanglement entropy, like strong subadditivity of entanglement entropy, and that we get the same type of flow, so FUV is bigger than F infrared. So we also had very nice discussions about this yesterday. There's still some controversy, but I think by now, maybe the proof is not as clean as it should, but I'm pretty confident that this holds. Many examples.
Does F appear, you know, as coefficient for heat capacity or entropy or thermoentropy at finite temperature?
That's a good question. I don't think so, but I don't know. Is Ben here?
No, it's not. It's not.
It's not the same, right?
No, there's counterexamples for the thermal entropy. That RG flip from the critical ON model to the Goldstone phase.
So there's no some kind of C theorem like for this coefficient thermal entropy.
It's not monotonic.
Right, it's worse than that. It's not that just we could not find that. There are counterexamples, so it's really wrong, the intuition. Okay. So this is Tuesday, I guess, right? Yesterday was this discussion about phi theorems. So Monday, it was supersymmetry. So far, I didn't give you any motivation for supersymmetry. So why study all these supersymmetric theories? And basically, is that the idea is that this is the perfect laboratory where we can do much more detailed and analytic calculation, so we can develop techniques that then we may try to extend to other more realistic conformal field theories, if you want. So in N equals 4, this is taken to the extreme. So there's like the spectrum of single trace operators is basically computed at any value of the coupling. Now there's a lot of progress in computing three-point functions. Four-point functions, we learned that it's easy to go to six loops doing four-point functions. So this is like our laboratory to develop methods. It was easy, right? No, not a single Feynman diagram.
It wasn't even necessarily easy to sit through the talk.
So the other thing that I think is very important about these super conformal examples is that they really show that the space, the landscape of conformal field theories is huge. Okay, so you have now we have a huge class of super conformal field theories just with N equals 2 supersymmetry. So actually constructed by Davide. And this just tells you that the landscape is huge. You really have to understand. And if we cannot find something, it's probably because we're not looking well enough. And the other thing that I wanted to say is this second strategy, which is basically what we can do in physics is that we have some free theory, we know how to calculate, and then we do perturbation theory around this free theory. Okay, so perhaps a better idea is to start from an interacting theory, which we still know how to calculate, and then we can deform a bit around that theory. It will be closer to a realistic model. So we can also think of this theory as a better starting point than free field theories. Okay, so I'll just give you a picture. So in 4D, I mean, the space is huge, as I said, but okay, let's choose these coordinates, A and C, this anomaly coefficient, and we can plot. And dots here are free theories. So if you go along this line, it's like theories of free bosons. If you go along this red line, it's theories of free gauge fields. And if you put free fermions, you move, I guess, like that in some diagonal way. Okay. So this is this is the space we can probe with free theories. Actually, with any theory continuously connected to free theories. because these anomalous coefficients cannot change under continuous deformations of the theory, and they're exactly marginal deformations of the theory. And another important thing is that if you really want to do quantum gravity in the sense that I was describing before, just a UV completion of general relativity, then you have to look for theories along this line, because general relativity tells you that C must be equal to A up to a very small correction, up to quantum correction. And okay, I actually put here n equals 4. This is U1 equal n equals 4. So of course, if you put more colors, you go higher and higher in A and C, but always along this diagonal. And in this picture, I also put here this forbidden region. Well, this is forbidden by some very clever argument of doing kind of a scattering experiment in a conformal field theory and demanding positivity of energy flux. So for some people, this is still controversial that this is a forbidden region, but I think the argument is pretty good, very physical. So we have this notion that, okay, this is a picture of the landscape for conformal field theories in these two coordinates.
Excuse me, I have a computer. You mentioned gravity corresponds to three-dimensional conformal fields, right?
Yes, this would be five-dimensional gravity, yeah.
Oh, I see. So you don't have a similar picture for the four-dimensional gravity and a three-dimensional.
For a three-dimensional, I mean, the question, so there's no anomaly coefficient, so at least there's no, these coordinates are not there. I could try to plot in this F, so yeah, you could do a similar plot in F and choosing, I don't know.
The question, because we know the four-dimensional gravity spectrum very well, because we're not going to be black.
No, but this is the same in.
We should know this coefficient of a thermal, this a thermal entropy. Whether that one can be calculated just from, say, conformal fields reproduce a four-dimensional gravity.
I think I'm going to answer your question in the open questions part. If it's not clear, you ask me again. Okay, so this is, let me move to the approach that gives the title to our program. So this we discussed this morning. It was very, very interesting. So, and here is where you really tackle the problem like in full force. You say, okay, let's look for conformal field theories. What are conformal field theories? Conformal field theory is just a consistent set of correlation functions. Now, what is a consistent set? What is consistency? So the basic thing that you have to demand is that you have an operator product expansion with a finite radius of convergence. Okay. So this is if you want, a defining property of a conformal field theory. So if you have such an operator product expansion, so you take the product of two operators at distinct points, you can express that as an infinite sum of operators, say at the origin, times OPE coefficients. So if you have this, you can basically compute any correlator, right? Because you can just successively use this OPE to reduce the number of operators in an endpoint function until you get to one-point functions, and then only the identity has a non-zero one-point function. All the other operators are zero. So this is why we call this the CFT data. Okay? If you know all these OPE coefficients and all the dimensions, you know how to compute all the correlators. Okay? This defines your conformal field theory. So now the question is, what is a consistent set of CFT data? And there's two basic things that you have to impose. One is unitarity, so essentially that this theory will define positive norm states when you actually do the Lorentzian theory. And the other one is associativity of the OPE. Okay? So unitarity gives you some obvious things. So for example, you can choose some basis, some real basis of operators where all the OPE coefficients are real. And it also gives you some bounds on the dimensions, okay? This is just for scalars, but gives you some lower bounds on the dimensions of the operators. Now, the more interesting consistency check comes from associativity of the OPE, okay? So say you look at a four-point function, okay? So we have these 4 points. And now we decide, let's first take the OP between the operator 1 and 2, and then take the OP between point 3 and 4. So this is represented in this figure. This is OPE, OPE. So I replace, and then I just get two-point functions. And essentially, I chose a basis of diagonal two-point functions. So you get this kind of expression. Okay. So this is a bit schematic, but the idea is that the four-point function gets expressed as a sum of these OP coefficients times some specific function that depends on the positions, but it's completely fixed by symmetry. Okay? It's called a conformal block. But now you see, this was a choice. I can also choose to take the OPE between, say, 1 and 3, and 2 and 4. And if I do that, I get another picture, okay, where I have the same type of functions, but essentially I permuted the points 1 and 3. So this is a very non-trivial consistency constraint on the CFT data. Okay. So I think this was first realized by Polyakov a long time ago, but essentially this is so hard that not much came out of it until very recently. So here, I'm running out of time, so let me just show you the latest, again, between Bootstrap 1 and Bootstrap 2, the latest application of these methods.
Just one question. Is IDA label old operator or just a primary field?
Here I'm being a bit not very precise, but in this equation it labels only primary fields. Conformal block, because the OP coefficient is not independent, right? If you know the OP coefficient with the primary, you also know the OP coefficient with the descending. So let me show you this picture. So this is the result of imposing this constraint on the space of the CFT data. And here, so let me explain you this plot. So we're doing a three-dimensional CFT, and we're looking at the four-point function of some scalar operator, let's call it sigma. Okay. So in their OPE, there will be many operators, and let's call epsilon the lowest dimension scalar operator that appears in their OPE. So what's plotted here is the allowed dimensions for this first scalar operator that appears as a function of the dimension of the external scalar operator. Okay? So you see this corner here corresponds to a free field in three dimensions. And so if it's a free field, you'll have just field squared, and it will have a dimension which is twice the original dimension. But as you increase the dimension of this field, you're allowed to increase the dimension of the first scalar operator that appears, but not arbitrarily large. There's a bump. And if you look at this, you see some very interesting structure there. There's like a knee in this curve. Okay? And actually, if you know your critical exponents by heart, you recognize that the Ising model sits exactly at that corner, okay? So let me just show you a zoom of that. So if you zoom in this region here, so this is the error bars for the best known critical exponents of the 3D Ising using either Monte Carlo or high temperature expansions. And you'll see that the curve goes right through it. So this method is essentially optimal for the Ising model. It really puts the Ising model at the boundary of the allowed CFTs. Okay, there's many games that you can play with this. We had a very nice discussion just before lunch today. And essentially the result of this is that I think it's fair to say that imposing some extra reasonable assumptions, you can get close to precision that was known before. So I mean, this is still work in progress, but the hope is that this algorithm can be turned into really a machine to find non-trivial conformal field theories. Okay, so this was my overview of what we're doing. So let me just finish with some random questions that I think are interesting. So one of them is what I just said. I mean, I think it would be really nice to have some algorithm that you give him. I want a conformal field theory central charge less than X, and the lowest dimension operator is bigger than Y, and the second dimension operator is like, look for a conformal field theory, and it will spit out one conformal field theory that satisfies my demands. This would be, I don't know, chemistry, they can kind of do that, no? They put molecules and then they connect an atom here, put a different molecule, and then I ask the computer, what is the specific heat or something like that? I think, hopefully, they can turn this into such kind of algorithm. So then there's this question about high dimensions. It's a bit of a formal question, so probably you're not very interested in this. But I mean, from free field theory, there's no way, I mean, any interaction that you turn on in higher dimensions is always irrelevant. So it's, there's no obvious way, how can you ever build some interacting CFT in D greater than 6? But from the conformal bootstrap program, it's not at all obvious that there's no solution. So it should be good to understand that. And okay, of course, the main point, I think, would be to actually find a CFT that does the job of UV completing pure Einstein gravity.
Sorry, but if you just impose a constant signal constraints, we know a solution from
to each of these questions.
To the third one.
To the first one?
The third one. Just use the holographic dictionary with pure gravity. That will obey all.
No, because it has an anomalous dimension. You will not, I mean.
No, the anomalous dimension one of our express.
No, but I want an exact. I mean, I want to solve the bootstrap exactly. A UV complete theory.
That's a solution.
No, come on.
It's a perturbative solution.
It's a perturbative solution, absolutely. How can you actually do that? And then I just put some random count at them. So the point is that I claim that order by order, 1 over n, I find a solution on the bootstrap.
Yes.
Just by cutting off the loop integrals in some disgusting random way, that's instead of solution.
But that's just using effective field theory to do general.
So you need some extra condition.
No, but I'm saying you should not do, you're not allowed to do 1 over n expansion. You have to give me a full finite n answer that solves the bootstrap.
You're missing parametrically many operators in this theory, right? You're missing most of the operators in this theory, you don't have them. You're computing some small sector of the theory. And you can show that just using this, the one you already put in the data.
So you really want a one parameter family for finite n?
Yes.
No, but even given the solution that you propose, we have big problems. Like you do what you want to do, but then you re-expand it into conformal blocks, and you find that some huge, very, very high dimensional operators will have negative OP coefficient square. So it's not a consistent solution.
I mean, the theory really has this sort of thing exclusion principle. It's always under a cut. Yeah, I've not seen those conditions in our context conditions. If you just want to solve constant symmetry perturbative, I think you can do it.
You don't solve unitarity, though. Yeah. And the perturbative expansion is an asymptotic expansion because effective field theory is an asymptotic expansion.
Absolutely.
So it's not summable. I mean, it doesn't converge.
If you're a fixed order perturbative theory, then you violate unitarity for operators.
So you want a non perturbative thing, and
I can ask. I don't know. So okay, it's one slide. So let me just finish. So maybe this is too hard because this is just, I mean, the space is huge. So maybe it's like some hard, complicated CFT that will do this. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. So maybe another way of approaching this question is, can we derive some general results from the assumptions that this CFT UV completes pure gravity? Okay, so let me give you one example of that. So in my definition of quantum gravity, I never mentioned black holes, right? I just required that you have the correct low energy excitation, so that graviton scattering will be the same as in general relativity. So from effective field theory point of view, black holes are just very high energy states that you should not be you don't have no right to expect to describe properly. However, we think gravity is special. So we think that very large black holes have very low curvature all the way up to the horizon. So they are actually good states even in, from this effective field theory point of view. So in fact, you should expect that you should be able, that any UV completion of gravity as I defined it should reproduce the black hole entropy, okay? But this is not at all obvious. So if I translate this question to conformal field theory language, it tells me that, okay, let me explain a bit more carefully. So if you put this CFT at finite temperature, I already told you there's some coefficient that controls the proportionality between the entropy density and the temperature. And this coefficient follows immediately from computing the entropy of a large black hole in anti de Sitter space. Okay? So essentially, this computation is related to computing a black hole in anti de Sitter space. But you can also measure, for example, the two-point function of stress tensors, and that will also be a measure of the Newton constant, okay? Because it's basically the normalization of the propagator, if you want. So gravity tells you that these two constants have to be the same, because the same Newton constant controls the black hole entropy and the graviton interaction, okay? But in a general CFT, they are not the same, they are different. So can we prove that if we satisfy this factorization and these gap assumptions, then necessarily this C has to be equal to C tilde? Okay, so this we could maybe prove even without finding an explicit example. So okay, this is the kind of problem that might be doable. Okay, I hope I convince you that we should keep searching in this big space for the diamond. Thank you very much. Yes.
There is a linked gravity of this omega k cubed dispersion relation. I wonder whether this kind of gravity have this holographic description. Basically, try to go away from linear dispersion. Whether this idea still works.
You mean this Ojava Lipschitz gravity,
yeah,
that breaks relativistic invariance?
At the low energy, this have this omega k cubed dispersion relation. It's no longer linear. The reason I ask this question is that this Lipschitz gravity may have a large amount of realizing. If they also have a holographic description, maybe comparison would be interesting.
But, well, I don't know all the details, but I thought that it was very unclear that this gravity would reduce this to general relativity at low energy, right?
So
it's a different theory.
And infrared is a different theory, but whether there's a holographic description, so it's a different theory.
But in the UV, it's also a different theory. So that theory, how do you know that theory doesn't have, for example, local observables? Can you also make the argument that theory must be holographic, that you can only measure observable points? Maybe it's not obvious to me that theory is not just a quantum field theory, that you just measure probes locally. But okay, yeah.
One question. So you mentioned supersymmetry twice, one with regard to this mass gap, and then again because we have very specific correspondences that exist that are sort of toy problems that we can play with. But I mean, are there hints just from the perspective of the CFT side, say this mass gap that forces you towards supersymmetry, or what role do you see that?
Depends who you ask. I think some people, I think Leonardo, for example, thinks that supersymmetry is very important, that you won't be able to do this without supersymmetry. Is that a fair statement?
I think it would be nice to prove
to prove that you cannot do.
I mean, what's the best you can hope for? You prove that there's no such thing as pure gravity.
Right.
That would be an amazing result.
So, but this depends who you ask. So some people think that might be the scenario. Many other people think that almost anything can be UV completed. So this is just a matter of looking better in the CFT space. So I think it's no. There's no unanimous answer.
Just to try and make a counterexample, you can imagine taking literally our world, which certainly does have a UV completion for gravity since we exist. And you can it can do this thing that Nima and collaborators were doing a while ago, compactifying, looking at landscapes at the standard model, and then you get a lower dimensional CFT, which is good.
This is this AVS 3 cross S1, right?
Yeah.
But we don't, I mean, are you saying that the standard model is the field measure? There's nothing from the standard model to Planck's? Yeah, I hope not.
Of course, that has nothing to do with it, right? If you know that you have a UV complete theory of quantum gravity, that UV completes the standard model because we exist, then all you need to know about in order to compute the compactification is the low energy modes. And so you can check that there actually is such a compactification, which is stable. And then you would say that that has to be dual to some CFT, which must be some exact CFT. I think the only way out is if our universe is unstable, which maybe it is. So, I mean, if there's some way that it can decay, then you might complain that it's not unitary.
But also, I mean, yeah, just experimentally, there is a big gap between Planck scale and our fields. unless you think that somehow the details of the standard model are essential for UV completion, you would guess that there are other theories with maybe no other fields other than gravity, which have a UV completion. So sure, they'll have lots of stuff, you know, at the Planck scale, but that would be, you know, that would still fit, I think, most people's definition of a UV completion of pure gravity, something that's gravity and then a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, at some near the Planck scale or something, right? And
right. That was my definition.
There's a good reason to think that, you know, we expect something like that to exist.
Do we expect or do we not expect?
I think we expect, because I think we think that it's not inconsistent with string theory for SUSY if it exists to be broken at a very high scale, and then all that stuff is just at some pair of, you know, at the Planck scale. Why do I need, I mean, what would it mean for this not to be true? What, I mean, let me ask it the other way around. What would be, you know, the statement that it's impossible to have a UV completion of pure gravity, but it's possible to have our world? How, what is it, what does that even mean?
But it means that it means that there are states not at Planck scale but parametrically lower necessarily.
So the standard model is an essential part.
Not the standard model, some other stuff which we haven't seen yet.
But
which exists at the Planck scale divided by a million, for example.
So it's sort of
but that's okay. That will still be in my class.
It's a question of whether you have more than one scale.
Yeah, the TV scale is already a huge gap compared to the CC.
Yeah, so you might as well call that massive. So you're saying that there's no theory where there's, without a second scale, it's much smaller than the Planck scale.
Yeah.
For example. It could be.
more questions? Not like I'm wrong, man.